After leaving a grim-looking Marshall Price in the street, Frank headed for Peter Lee's hash house. The proprietor, his pretty wife, and their two children were busy at this time of day, but Frank found an empty stool at the counter and ordered the lunch special, steak, potatoes, greens, and apple pie. When Lee put the plate in front of Frank, he nodded toward the window.
Lots of excitement out there in the street a little while ago. I figured it'd be better if I kept my wife and the little ones in here while it was going on.
You were right about that.
They say more men were killed by the terror.
That's what it looked like, all right.
A little while ago, I saw those men who came in here and caused all that trouble last night. They went by the window. I think they were headed into the Bull of the Woods.
Any of them appear to be hurt?
One of them had a bloody rag tied around his arm. And another was walking really funny, like there was something wrong with his, well, his rear end.
If Erickson and the rest of those men bother you, Peter, you let me know. I don't think they will, though. Their grudge is against me, not you.
Don't worry. I have a shotgun here under the counter in case of trouble. Those varmints come in here and try to start anything, they'll wish they hadn't when they get a face full of buckshot.
Frank enjoyed his lunch. He could see why the hash house did such good business. The food was delicious. There wasn't much ambience, as highfalutin folks in cities like San Francisco and Boston like to talk about. But a man couldn't fill his belly with ambience, now could he? He was cleaning up the last of his apple pie when Lee paused in front of him, nodding toward the front window.
Look there, Mr. Morgan.
Frank turned his head and looked out the window as a large black carriage rolled past, pulled by a pair of big black horses in fancy silver rigging. The carriage had a lot of silver trim on it, too.
Looks almost like a hearse.
No, that's no hearse. That's Mr. Rutherford Chamberlain's carriage.
Frank set his fork on the empty saucer where the pie had been and stood up. He slid a coin onto the counter to pay for his meal.
I'll get your change.
That's okay. I'll see you later, Peter.
Be careful, Mr. Morgan. I have a feeling there are a lot of people around here who harbor ill wishes for you.
Well, that's been true just about every place I've ever gone in my life.
Frank stepped out of the hash house and looked up the street. The carriage had come to a stop in front of the hotel. Frank's powerful stride carried him in that direction. He was passing the vehicle when he heard,
Mr. Morgan?
Frank paused and looked over at the carriage. It had fine silk curtains over the windows to keep out the dust, but those curtains had been pushed back at one window, and Nancy Chamberlain peered out at Frank with a worried expression on her pretty face.
Mr. Morgan, have you found out anything about...
Frank moved closer to the window and glanced at the driver's seat on the front of the carriage. It was empty at the moment, and he wondered if the driver was in one of the saloons, wetting his whistle.
Miss Chamberlain, what brings you and your father to town? I assume he came along, too.
He's in the hotel. He's looking for you. He's furious, Mr. Morgan. One of his workers came to the house and told him that 11 more men had been killed at one of our camps this morning. Killed by the terror. I can't believe that. Do you know if it really happened? Or is it just some terrible rumor?
Those men were killed, all right. I saw their bodies when they were brought in.
Oh, dear Lord. Have you found out anything yet? Found any sign of...
I found that cabin you told me about. It looked like nobody had been there for months.
Yes. He started shunning it for some reason. Almost like something happened there that upset him. Father flew into a rage when he heard about the latest deaths. He even ordered the servants to get the carriage ready and said we were coming to town. He's looking for you, Mr. Morgan. He wants the terror killed now, and if you can't do it, he's going to reinstate the bounty.
That's not a good idea. He needs to give me more time.
Morgan!
I think your time has run out, Mr. Morgan.
Chamberlain stomped down from the hotel porch and came toward the carriage. He wore a white suit today with a flat-crowned white hat and looked more like a southern plantation owner than a timber baron.
What the devil are you doing talking to my daughter?
Just saying hello to the young lady. She told me you were looking for me. I was about to go into the hotel and find you.
Oh, somehow I doubt that. You have to explain yourself, sir.
Explain what?
Why haven't you killed that unholy creature yet?
It's been less than 24 hours since we came to our agreement, Mr. Chamberlain. I don't reckon that's really giving me a fair chance to do the job now, is it?
You haven't had time to find the terror and kill it, but the monster has had time to slaughter a dozen more of my men. Is that fair?
I was in the woods this morning. I found one of the victims and brought him in. You didn't know about that, did you?
It doesn't matter. That creature has to be found and killed. Now! Several of my foremen came to the house just before Nancy and I left and told me that the loggers don't want to leave their barracks anymore. They're afraid to do their work. I can't allow that, Morgan. My business will collapse if the men won't go into the woods.
Just give me some more time.
How much time? Till every man Jack who works for me has been ripped to shreds?
Give me another 24 hours.
And if you haven't found the Terror by then?
I reckon you'll do whatever it is you think you have to do.
I'll put that bounty back on the monster's head. Only it won't be $10,000 next time, it'll be $20,000.
Frank bit back a curse. Quite a few people had gathered around to watch the angry confrontation between him and Chamberlain, and they all heard what the Timber Baron had just said. In half an hour, maybe less, nearly everybody in Eureka would know that Chamberlain was talking about reinstating the bounty and doubling it.
24 hours. We have a deal.
All right. 24 hours. But not a minute more. If you haven't brought that monster's head to me by that time, you're finished, Morgan.
Chamberlain turned away and started looking for his driver. Frank nodded at Nancy, then went into the hotel. He wanted to gather some extra gear. Once he went into the woods the next time, he wouldn't be coming out again until he had found what he was looking for. When he came back downstairs a short time later with a pair of full saddlebags draped over his shoulder, he found Dr. Patrick Connolly waiting in the lobby.
Could I have a moment of your time, Mr. Morgan?
Sure. I was on my way to the livery stable, if you'd like to walk along with me.
That will be fine.
What can I do for you, Doctor?
A short time ago, you asked me to confirm something for you, Mr. Morgan. Now I'd like for you to confirm something for me. You strike me as an observant, intelligent man, and even though you've only been in this area for a short time, you've seen several of the victims attributed to this so-called terror.
Funny how people keep putting so-called in front of the thing's name. I've done it myself.
That's because at this point, no one is certain what it really is. We can't be until it's killed or captured.
Seems like a man would have a mighty tough chore on his hands if he set out to capture a thing like that.
Indeed. But my point, Mr. Morgan, is that these bodies today struck me as being slightly different from the previous victims. I was wondering if you noticed the same thing.
You don't think the Terror killed those men Wilcox brought in from the logging camp?
Not unless it's learned how to wield an axe. Those poor devils were chopped apart, not torn apart. I suspect that they were shot first as well, so the mutilation was post-mortem. But I'd have to dig into their bodies and find the bullets to prove that. Whoever took an axe to them was careful to obliterate the gunshot wounds.
Have you told anybody else about this? Like the marshal?
Gene Price is an honest man, a good man despite his gruff nature. And he does a good job of keeping the peace here in town. But dealing with violence on this scale, with cold-blooded mass murder, that's a little beyond him, I'm afraid. There's enough panic in the region already because of the Terror. If people knew that a gang of vicious murderers was roaming the countryside as well, it wouldn't take much to set off riots among the loggers, and that could easily spread to the town.
That's what I thought. That's why I've kept quiet about it.
Who do you think could be responsible for such an atrocity?
Only one man I can think of. Chamberlain's competition, Emmett Bosworth.
Bosworth? He's in town, you know.
He is?
He's staying at the Eureka House. Has this big suite right up in front on the second floor. He's been here off and on for months. He has a small timber lease up the coast, so it's not unreasonable for him to be here to check on his holdings. Everyone knows he's got his eye on Chamberlain's trees, though.
I'd like to talk to him, but I don't have time right now.
Yes, Mr. Chamberlain's deadline. I heard about that. Do you believe you can find the Terror in that amount of time?
I'm gonna try, that's for sure.
Mr. Morgan, that bone you showed me, does that have something to do with the Terror?
It might. I don't know yet.
I have a safe in my office. I'll lock it up so that it'll be secure.
I'd appreciate that. So long, Doctor.
Good luck, Mr. Morgan. Or should I say, good hunting.
Son of a bitch.
Emmett Bosworth let the curtain fall closed over the window. He'd had it pushed back only a few inches, leaving a small gap through which he could watch as Frank Morgan carried on an earnest conversation with Dr. Patrick Connolly. Bosworth knew Connolly from the time he had spent here in Eureka, and he had heard a great deal about Frank Morgan. Supposedly, Rutherford Chamberlain had hired the notorious gunfighter to find the Terror, And according to the conversations Bosworth had overheard in the hotel dining room a few minutes earlier, Chamberlain had now given Morgan a 24-hour deadline to kill the creature. That wouldn't do at all. For his plans to succeed, he needed the terror, whatever it was, to continue its occasional depredations. That way, the terror would be blamed for the things Bosworth's men were actually doing. The Eureka House had a bell system, so that all Bosworth had to do to summon a porter was to push a button. He did so now, and a few minutes later, a knock came on the door. Bosworth opened it to see an elderly black man in a red jacket waiting in the hallway.
Can I do something for you, Mr. Bosworth, sir?
Do you know a man named Jack Grimshaw?
Seen him around, yes, sir.
Find him. Tell him I need to talk to him as soon as possible.
Bosworth took a silver dollar from his pocket and flipped it to the old man. The coin disappeared smoothly into a pocket of the red jacket.
There'll be another one of those for you if you don't say a word to anyone about this ever. You understand?
Yes, sir.
And if you do go shooting off your mouth, I'll make you sorry that Abe Lincoln ever set you free.
No, sir. That won't happen.
Bosworth nodded curtly and shut the door. He paced back and forth the next 15 minutes while he waited for Grimshaw. When a knock sounded on the door again, Bosworth stalked over to it and jerked it open. Grimshaw stood there, a puzzled look on his rugged face.
You wanted to see me, Mr. Bosworth?
Come inside. Have you ever heard of a man named Frank Morgan?
Morgan? You mean the Drifter? Yeah, sure, I heard of him. Just about everybody west of the Mississippi has.
I thought you might know who he was, since you're in the same line of work. Are you actually acquainted with him?
We've crossed trails a time or two over the years.
See the sort of man who can be paid off?
Paid off? To do what?
To go away and mind his own business.
Frank Morgan? Paid to give up a job he's agreed to do? Not hardly.
You sure of that?
I'd stake my life on it.
Very well, then. I have a new job for you and your men, Grimshaw.
Thought you said you wouldn't be needing us for a while.
Well, that was before other matters came up. You'll have to leave this afternoon.
Where are we going? What's the job?
You're going to follow Frank Morgan into the woods and kill him.
Why do you want Morgan dead?
I'm not in the habit of having my orders questioned, Grimshaw, or of explaining myself.
Yeah, well, you never sent me after a man like Morgan either. You know, sometimes folks have another name for him besides the Drifter. They call him the Last Gunfighter.
That's preposterous. There are scores of gunfighters left in the West. Hundreds, perhaps. You're one yourself, and so are the men who ride with you.
Not the same thing. Yeah, I'm pretty slick on the draw, and I hit what I shoot at. Those other boys are the same way. But Frank Morgan, well, he's in a class by himself. Ben Thompson and Wes Hardin are dead. Smoke Jensen, Falcon McAllister, Matt Bodine. They've all hung up their guns, and they're making it stick somehow. That old-timer called Preacher? Well, hell, he's got to be dead by now. Even though I never heard anybody who knew for sure say that he is. But Morgan, he's still in the game. And still as good as he ever was, from what I've heard.
So what you're telling me is that you're afraid of this man.
I'm telling you that Frank Morgan is a mighty dangerous man, and I respect that. I'd be a damn fool not to. And my mama back in Texas didn't raise any fools.
More dangerous than 15 men who are supposed to be good with their guns?
14. We lost Nichols this morning.
So the odds are 14-1. And yet you hesitate to go after Morgan?
I didn't say we wouldn't do it.
Ah, you want more than your usual pay.
What I want is to know why. What's so important about Morgan that you have to send us after him?
Isn't it obvious? Chamberlain has given him the job of tracking down the terror and killing it. If this man Morgan is actually as dangerous as you claim he is, he might succeed. We can't allow that.
Because you need the terror to stay out there in the woods, so he'll get blamed for anything me and the rest of the men do for you.
Exactly. Perhaps your mother really didn't raise any fools. Although I'd say that the jury's still out on that question.
It didn't bother you when Chamberlain had that 10 grand bounty on the critter, and there were men all over the woods looking for it.
The chances of any of those men actually finding and killing the terror, or even of surviving the encounter, were so slim that I wasn't worried. But as you yourself say, Morgan is different. 5,000.
What? You mean you give us 5,000 for this job?
No. I'll give you 5,000, and 5,000 more to split among your men. Chamberlain put up a bounty of $10,000 for the man who kills the Terror. It's worth that much to me to keep the thing alive for a while longer.
Chamberlain's talking about doubling it to 20 grand, you know.
Don't push it, Grimshaw. That's my offer. 5 to you, 5 to your men.
And if I don't take it?
Then I'll make the same offer to, say, Radburn. He seems like a tough, competent man.
All right. It's a deal.
Good.
Bosworth glanced out the window, then lifted a hand and summoned Grimshaw over.
There he is now, leaving the livery barn. He'll be riding out of town. Follow him, kill him. Simple as that. And when you come back, I'll have $10,000 in cold, hard cash waiting for you.
Grimshaw nodded and left the hotel room. Normally, he shook hands to seal a deal, but he didn't particularly want to shake Emmett Bosworth's hand. Frank walked out of the livery stable, leading Stormy and Boldy. The rangy gray stallion wore the saddle right now, but Frank intended to take both horses along on this trip, despite the fact that he had ridden Goldie that morning. He didn't know how long he would be away from town. He had packed supplies to last for several days. If he didn't find the Terror before the deadline Chamberlain had given him, that didn't mean he was going to abandon the search. He intended to keep looking until he located the creature and determined once and for all whether Nancy Chamberlain was right about it being her brother. If it wasn't, if it was some sort of animal, Frank intended to kill it. Even though the Terror wasn't guilty of all the charges that had been leveled against it, there was no doubt that it had attacked and killed more than a dozen men.
This thing has to be stopped.
Well, better you than me going out there.
I appreciate the good care you've taken of my friends. We'll see you when we get back to town.
Sure thing. By the way, I went down to the Undertaker's and had a look at that dead fella the way you asked me to.
Did you recognize him?
Yeah, I think he kept his horse here for a few nights when he first got to town. That was a while back, a couple of months ago maybe, so I can't be completely sure, but I believe I'm right.
You remember if he was traveling with anybody else?
Not really. Like I said, it's been a while.
Well, I appreciate it anyway. You say he only kept his horse here for a few nights?
Right. I reckon he found some place permanent to stay and was able to keep his horse there. That's just a guess, but it's all I've got, Mr. Morgan.
I'm obliged.
Frank mounted up and lifted a hand in farewell, then turned the horses toward the end of the street. Wolf trotted alongside as Frank rode out of Eureka. He headed southwest, toward the thick band of timber that ran for miles along the Pacific coast, south of Humboldt Bay. Thick clouds were forming over the ocean, Frank saw. They didn't look particularly threatening, but they would block some of the sunlight and make the twilight world under the redwoods more shadowy than ever. No telling what might be lurking in that gloom. The Terror wasn't the only thing he had to worry about, he reminded himself. He'd been shot at several times during the 24 hours he'd been in this part of the country, including the previous afternoon when he had first visited Ben Chamberlain's cabin. That incident had been lurking in the back of his mind. Something about it didn't quite jive, and as he rode along the logging road now, penetrating deeper into the woods, he thought about what had happened at the cabin. That was before the ruckus with Erickson and his friends, before it was even widely known that Rutherford Chamberlain had given him the job of finding the Terror. So who had taken those pot shots at him when he stepped out of the cabin? Frank had no answer for that, but it was one more mystery to solve once he had taken care of his more pressing problem.
Stay alert, Wolf.
They entered the towering trees. Wolf's senses always operated at peak efficiency. Frank had recognized a landmark, a particular tree with a long blaze down its side from a lightning strike. The tree had survived, but it would be marked for all eternity by what had happened to it. One more way trees and men were alike, Frank reflected as he rode past the redwood.
20 grand. Big share of that bounty would go a long way toward making things all right again.
Yeah, your balls wouldn't make as much if you had a pocket full of dinero, would they?
Let's leave my balls out of this. And Sutherland's ass and Royalston's nose, too. Let's face it. All of us have plenty of reasons for wanting that bastard Morgan dead, even without the bounty.
But 20 grand always helps.
None of the six men could argue with that. They had ridden out of Eureka about half an hour after Frank Morgan left town. Royalston, Jenkins, and Sutherland had all worked for Rutherford Chamberlain before the danger from the Terror had spooked them into quitting, so they knew the woods quite well. Erickson intended to put that knowledge to good use. In fact, he had gotten Jenkins, the smartest of the trio, to draw a map of the timberland southwest of the settlement. There was a low range of hills to the east, the Pacific to the west, and the Eel River running into the ocean about 20 miles south of Eureka. Within those boundaries were some of the biggest trees in the world, and those were also the stomping grounds of the Terror. The three loggers knew every place the monster had struck. Chances are Morgan would be scouting around those same locations, and Erickson and his companions would be scouting for Morgan.
Here's what we'll do. Once we've taken care of Morgan, we'll go ahead and start looking for the Terror. If we find it, we can kill it and hide the body somewhere. Then we'll go back to town to wait until Old Man Chamberlain has given up on Morgan and posted the $20,000 bounty. Then we'll go back to wherever we stashed the body, cut off the head, and take it back to collect. How's that sound?
It sounds like you ain't hurting for confidence. Hell, it ain't the middle of the afternoon yet. Plenty of time to hunt down and kill Morgan and the Terror.
I'm just saying, if it works out that way, that's how we'll do it.
Sounds good to me. I just as soon get this over with as quick as we can. Don't much like it out here.
The wind picked up a short time later. They really couldn't feel it much where they were, but they could see the trees swaying a little if they looked up.
Is it gonna storm?
Nah, those weren't storm clouds coming in from the ocean. It might drizzle a little, that's all. You'd hardly feel it under here.
I wouldn't want to get caught in these trees during a thunderstorm. Too much lightning.
Hell, you be safe. Everything around here is a whole heap taller than a man. What you have to worry about with lightning is it starting a fire. We've had enough rain lately, so that's not a real threat right now.
Erickson took the map Jenkins had drawn out of his shirt pocket and unfolded it to study it. He motioned Jenkins up alongside him and conferred with the former logger for a moment.
How about we all just shut up for a while? We're getting into an area where the Terror has been spotted several times. In fact, the damn thing killed a man not far from here. We don't want it sneaking up on us while we're busy running our mouths, do we?
The men shook their heads as Erickson looked at them one by one. He had just gotten that response from Sutherland when something came flashing out from behind a tree and jerked the man right out of the saddle. Frank heard the gunshots and screams from somewhere behind him and reined Stormy to a halt. He hipped around in the saddle to peer through the trees, but of course he couldn't see more than about 50 yards in any direction because of all the thick redwood trunks. Those sounds were all too familiar to Frank. They were the sounds of the Terror going about its bloody business. Wolf had turned around too and pricked his ears forward. The hair on the back of his neck was ruffled up.
Yeah, Wolf, that sounds like what we're looking for. Go get it.
Wolf took off like a shot. Frank rode after him, leading Goldie and trusting Stormy to find the fastest route through the woods. It sounded like the men were coming toward Frank at the same time he was headed toward them.
Wolf!
Frank jerked the Winchester from its saddle sheath and worked the rifle's lever. At the same instant, something came crashing through the undergrowth and burst out right in front of Frank. Stormy collided with whatever the thing was. Frank caught only a glimpse of it before Stormy went down and he was sent sailing through the air. In that brief second, though, he was aware of its massive size, its shaggy pelt, and its blinding speed as it ran upright with something slung over one shoulder. Frank thought that something was a man. Then he crashed into a tree trunk, bounced off, and went rolling across the ground. The impact stunned him, and although a part of his brain cried out for him to get up and find the Winchester he had just dropped, his muscles refused to respond. All he could do was lie there with the world spinning crazily around him. He was at the mercy of the Terror. There was no doubt in Frank's mind that was what he had just seen. The huge hairy beast was what had been killing men all through these woods for months. This encounter contained something new, though. The Terror had had a prisoner. Maybe that was keeping it occupied. Maybe that was why it hadn't fallen on Frank already and ripped him limb from limb. Frank suddenly felt coarse hair against his face. He jerked away from it, some deep atavistic instinct finally forcing his muscles to work again. Then relief washed through him as he saw Wolf's face only inches away from his own. The big cur peered intently at him with a mixture of curiosity and concern. Frank was starting to come out of the shock of slamming into the tree like that. He reached up, looped an arm over Wolf's sturdy back. and braced himself that way as he pulled himself into a sitting position. Wolf licked his face happily. Frank recalled the animal's yelp a few minutes earlier, and he looked him over for any sign of an injury. He didn't see any blood. Maybe Wolf had just been scared. Such a thing was mighty rare, but not impossible. Frank had felt some fear of his own during that instant when he'd gotten a close-up look at the terror. Unfortunately, everything had happened so fast that he still didn't know if it was man or beast. The shaggy pelt said animal, but he had never seen an animal move that fast on two legs. Whatever it was gone now. He didn't see it anywhere. He was about to have other company, though.
Sutherland!
Oh, my God! Oh, what the... What was that?
Damn it, Sutherland! Can you hear me?
Erickson, did you see that thing? The way it snatched Sutherland off his horse, I never saw anything like that in my life!
Erickson, Frank thought. The men coming toward him wanted him dead. Might be a good idea not to be just sitting here in the forest when they came along. He glanced around for Stormy and Goldie, but didn't see either of the horses. They would be somewhere close by, he knew, and would come if he whistled for them. It might be better to just let them stay where they were, though, at least for the moment. He spotted his Winchester and his hat lying nearby and reached for them, wincing as pain shot through him when he leaned over. He might have cracked a rib or two, he thought. Getting hold of the rifle's barrel, he drew the weapon toward him and then planted the butt against the ground. He used it as a makeshift crutch to lever himself to his feet, being careful not to let the barrel point at him as he did so. When he was standing again, he hobbled toward the closest redwood. The sounds of horses and men were very close now. Erickson and his cronies would be coming in sight at any moment. Frank hurried as much as he could, motioning for Wolf to follow him. They went around the tree, which was about 12 feet wide at the base, and then Frank stopped and leaned back against the trunk. He stood there with the Winchester slanted across his chest, ready to fight if he had to. Wolf sat at his feet, still and silent, except for an occasional whine that showed how much he wanted to tear into the hombres searching through the woods. Frank would shoot it out with Erickson's bunch if he had to, but shaken up and on foot as he was, it would be better if they didn't find him right now. To increase the chances of that, he stayed absolutely still, barely even breathing, as the searchers moved closer and closer. The wind blew through the treetops high overhead. Frank felt a few drops of drizzle on his face as the moisture filtered down through the thick canopy of branches. Then a couple of riders passed by, not more than 20 feet away from him. All they would have had to do to see him was turn their heads, but they never looked in his direction. He recognized the big red-bearded Erickson and one of the other men whose names he hadn't heard.
Sutherland's gone. We're never going to see him again, Erickson.
We don't know that.
The hell we don't! You saw that thing carry him off. It's going to eat him. That's what it's going to do. You know how loco an animal is once it gets a taste for human flesh.
Shut up! I don't want to hear that kind of talk.
Why else would it carry him off instead of just killing him? We know Sutherland was alive the last time we saw him. He was still hollering. The damn beast will probably keep him alive and just eat him a little bit at a time.
Jenkins, I told you to shut the hell up!
The men passed on out of sight. Frank didn't relax because they were gone, however. He knew there were probably several other men in the group, and they'd be moving around in the area, searching for the missing man, too. A moment later, he heard the other men off to his left, but they didn't come as close to him as Erickson and Jenkins had. They moved on into the forest, searching for the long-gone Sutherland. Frank waited until all the men were gone, then signaled his horses. It took him a couple of tries before noises in the brush told him that Stormy and Goldie were responding. The horses pushed through the undergrowth and emerged near the tree where Frank waited. He still leaned against the trunk because it hurt when he tried to straighten up. Stormy came over to him, nuzzled his shoulder.
Good fella.
Frank slid the Winchester back in its sheath, then grasped the saddle horn with both hands. He got his left foot in the stirrup and pulled himself up into the saddle. Pain shot through him again, but he told himself to ignore it. More than likely, those ribs were just bruised. Frank didn't bother with Goldie's reins. He knew the horse would follow Stormy.
Get the scent, Wolf. The critter ran right through here. You can pick up his trail.
Wolf cast back and forth, nose to the ground, for a couple of minutes, then stood stiff-legged, signifying that he had found the scent of something that bothered him. He had reacted the same way to the terror's scent earlier.
Good boy. Trail, Wolf!
Wolf took off through the brush. Frank followed. A fine mist continued to fall. The trees shielded Frank from most of it, but he felt its wet touch on his face from time to time. Actually, it was sort of refreshing, so he didn't care about the rain. It wasn't coming down hard enough to wash away the scent that Wolf was following. Every so often, he heard Erickson and his companions in the distance, still looking for the missing Sutherland. But the trail Wolf was following veered more toward the ocean, taking him and Frank away from the area where Erickson and the others were. The Terror had changed direction as it charged through the woods.
That's it, Wolf. Good dog.
The big cur began to pick up speed, as if the scent were getting stronger. But then Wolf slowed suddenly and came to a stop with his hackles raised. Frank reined Stormy to a halt, drew the Winchester, and looked around. He didn't see anything moving. Wolf was gazing intently at a spot a few yards ahead, at the thick base of a tree. Frank looked at the same place, but didn't see a thing other than a few dark spots on the ground.
Hush, Wolf, hush!
Wolf obeyed, and the thick silence closed in around them. Frank listened. He didn't hear anything, except the sound a big drop of rain made when it fell and landed. But there weren't any big raindrops today, only the fine mist. But there was another dark spot at the base of the tree now, Frank noticed, as a little shock ran through him. He tilted his head back and looked up, his gaze following the trunk of the redwood until it reached the spot where branches began protruding from the tree. Crammed into the angle between one of those lower branches and the trunk itself was the body of a man. It dangled there precariously, and as Frank watched, another huge drop of blood fell like a crimson rain at the base of the tree. He reckoned he'd found the missing Sutherland. How in the world had the Terror gotten the body up there? At the tree's base, the trunk was much too big for a man to wrap his arms and legs around it and shinny up, although it narrowed considerably by the area where the branches began growing. The trunk wasn't smooth. The bark that covered it was rough and seamed with fissures, but it would take an incredible amount of strength to seek out handholds and footholds and scale the tree that way, at the same time carrying a man's corpse. One thing the Terror didn't seem to lack for, Frank reminded himself, was strength. A creature that could rip a man's arms off his body was capable of some prodigious feats. It hadn't done a very good job of wedging the corpse into place either. As Frank watched, the body began to slip. There was nothing he could do to prevent it from falling, so he lifted the reins and backed Stormy away from the tree, getting well out of the way.
Come on, Wolf.
Goldie retreated as well. A few moments later, the body slipped free. It plummeted toward the earth, turning over once as it fell. It landed at the base of the tree, in the same place where the blood drops had landed. Frank edged Stormy forward. He dismounted and walked over to the dead man, carrying the Winchester with him. The man had landed face down. Frank hooked a toe under his shoulder and rolled him onto his back. The body moved limply. The fall seemed to have broken numerous bones. The man's throat was torn open, and there were deep wounds on his chest as well. His face was relatively unmarked, though. Frank recognized him as one of the loggers who had come into Peter Lee's place with Erickson and the others the night before. Frank left the body where it had fallen. There was nothing else he could do.
Find that scent again, boy. Find the critter.
Wolf circled wide around the trees where the corpse lay, and then trotted back and forth until he picked up the scent again. Then he took off eagerly, still heading toward the coast. 15 minutes later, Frank rode out into a clearing that ran along the top of a cliff. The open area was narrow, only 50 yards or so wide, but it ran for hundreds of yards, as far as Frank could see in both directions. And directly in front of him, stretching out endlessly, was the gray, restless sea. The clearing had a nice carpet of grass on it. Frank rode across it toward the sheer rock face, where land ended and the sea began. He had seen the Pacific before, on numerous occasions, but it never failed to impress him. Wolf had trotted right over to the brink, and now stood there staring out at the ocean, the wind ruffling his thick coat. Frank rode up to join Wolf. He dismounted and peered over the cliff as he hung on to Stormy's reins. He had no special fear of heights, but he believed in giving natural dangers the respect they deserved.
Nothing down there but rocks.
The constant action of the waves had rounded the large gray stones. It was an impressive scene. Frank didn't see what it had to do with his quarry, though. The Terror wasn't down there, and there was no place for the thing to hide along this rugged cliff.
Where'd it go, Wolf? Find the scent. Wolf, hunt!
The big cur started searching for the scent again. He seemed to have it in short order and began trotting along the edge of the cliff. Frank mounted up and followed. After 100 yards or so, Wolf turned and headed toward the trees again. So the Terror had come out here, stood at the edge of the ocean for a time, and then gone back to its woodland home. Frank had just pulled Stormy's head around to start after Wolf, when Flame suddenly lanced out from the shadows underneath the big trees. He felt a slug whizzing past his ear. Then more shots blasted from the trees, a whole volley of them, and Frank knew that out here at the edge of the world, with bushwhackers in front of him and the endless sea behind him, there was no cover, no place to fort up. He was trapped. Frank kicked his feet free of the stirrups and threw himself out of the saddle as lead stormed around him. Miraculously, though, he hit the ground without being wounded.
Go, Stormy! Goldie, get out of here!
At the same time, Wolf turned around and started to come back toward him.
No, Wolf! Into the woods, go!
Wolf hesitated, then whirled around and raced toward the trees, angling away from the gunfire as he stretched out in a dead run. He vanished into the thick shadows under the redwoods. By this time, Frank was rolling desperately toward the edge of the cliff, toward a spot where the ground sloped slightly toward the brink. He had caught sight of it as he was diving off Stormy's back, and he knew it represented the closest thing to any cover he was going to find out here. Bullets still sizzled through the air around him. Pain suddenly lanced into his left arm, and Frank knew he was hit. He gritted his teeth and tried to ignore it, just as he had been ignoring the pain from those bruised ribs. He reached the place where the ground fell away toward the cliff and rolled onto it. It was no more than 10 feet by 10 feet, just a slight depression, but it was enough to put some earth between him and the men trying to kill it. Unfortunately, there was nowhere to go from here. He was pinned down about as securely as a man could be. But he still had hold of his rifle and had quite a bit of ammunition in his pockets. So if those gunmen hidden under the trees decided to rush him, he could make them pay a price for killing him. Frank lay stretched out on his belly on the damp grass, which grew all the way to the cliff's edge. He tried not to think about the fact that only a couple of feet behind him lay yawning, deadly emptiness with rocks and sea at the bottom. As the mist continued to fall and make his clothes even wetter, he looked over at his left arm to see how badly he was hit. Blood stained the sleeve of his shirt about halfway between his shoulder and elbow. Frank moved the arm, and even though doing so hurt like blazes, the muscles still obeyed him, and he didn't feel anything grating together. So the bullet had missed the bone, he thought. The humerus, he remembered Dr. Patrick Connolly calling it, and had just torn through flesh. And it had gone all the way through as well, Frank knew, because he could feel distinct entry and exit wounds as they throbbed. The loss of blood could still be dangerous, but from the rate at which the crimson fluid leaked onto his shirt, he could tell that the slug hadn't nicked any veins or arteries. With even rudimentary medical attention, the wounds ought to heal. His arm should be fine. Of course, there was still a little matter of surviving this ambush. The shots died away, as the men in the trees realized that they couldn't see him anymore. Now they would be debating what they ought to do next, whether to rush him or try to wait him out. Frank cast a glance at the sky, which was completely gray and overcast by now. There were still a number of hours of daylight left, but if the bushwhackers waited too long and night fell, Frank might be able to slip away in the darkness. They had to be as aware of that as he was. Frank knew better than to think the bushwhackers were gone, though. They were still there, hidden in the shadows, waiting to kill him if he showed even the slightest glimpse of himself.
I never seen a man move that fast in my life, Jack. With more than a dozen of us open firing on him at the same time, how in hell did he manage not to get hit? He should have been filled full of holes.
There's some sort of guardian angel looking out for Frank Morgan. Always has been, ever since we were kids. Why do you think I always tried to make sure him and me were on the same side every time we got mixed up in some ruckus? Until now, that is.
You reckon he fell off the cliff?
Well, I don't rightly know. Why don't you mosey out there, Hooley, and see if you can tell?
You're trying to get me killed.
Thinning the herd.
Chances are Morgan found some cover, even though from here it doesn't look like there is any. He's the best I ever seen at using whatever luck gives him. The best I ever seen at anything, period. But he's still human. He can't sprout wings and fly off that cliff, and there's nowhere else for him to go.
But if we leave these trees, he'll have a clear shot at us. I don't want to try crossing 50 yards of open ground while I'm in the drifter's gun sights. Seems like a good way of committing suicide.
None sure.
Then how are we gonna get him out of there?
An idea glimmered to life in Grimshaw's brain. He looked up at the trees towering above them. The redwoods were all at least 150 feet tall, and many of them were taller than that.
Any of you boars know anything about cutting down trees? None of you ever worked as a logger before?
I always had better things to do with my hands than swing an axe.
Yeah, I'll bet, considering how the ladies feel about you.
Settle down, dammit. We got a real problem here. If we don't deal with Morgan before it gets dark, he'll have a lot better chance of giving us a slip. I want some of you boys to head for that logging camp we hit this morning and bring back all the axes and saws you can carry.
What's the laws there? Or some guards or somebody from Chamberlain's company?
Then wait until they're gone or find another camp or figure something out, dammit. Just get axes and saws and, oh yeah, some of those steel wedges loggers drive into the trees when they're cutting them down. Mallets to drive them, too.
The hell you got in mind, Jack?
We're gonna use the weapons that the good Lord was so thoughtful in providing for us.
How hard can it be to cut down a tree?
An hour went by. Frank's clothes were soaked by now. The fine mist in the air might not amount to much in the way of actual rainfall, but it would get a man wet if he were out in it long enough. A while earlier he had heard hoofbeats in the forest, fading into the distance, but he knew better than to think all the bushwhackers were gone. Later, the riders came back. A few minutes after that, he heard axes biting into wood. What in blazes were they doing? Cutting down a tree? That was the only explanation for the sounds. Frank had to risk raising his head just enough to take a look. As soon as his eyes came over the level of the ground, muzzle fire lanced from several places under the trees as shots cracked out. He ducked and felt the dirt kicked up by the bullets spray over him. Even that quick glance he had gotten had been enough to tell him that several of the men were working with axes on one of the trees at the very edge of the forest. Frank studied the tree, tilting his head back enough so that he could run his gaze all the way up the thick trunk to the top. It was close to 200 feet tall, he estimated, which meant that when it fell, if it toppled in the direction of the cliff, it would reach the spot where he had taken cover. The bastards were going to drop a tree on him. If the tree landed on him, he'd undoubtedly be squashed flatter than a flapjack. And if he jumped out to run out of the way when the tree started to fall, the gunman would be waiting for him, waiting to cut him down with rifle fire instead of saws and axes. He had to make them think twice about continuing with their plan. Moving fast, he raised himself enough to thrust the Winchester toward the trees and trigger a shot. That was the only round he got off, though, because the men who weren't working on the tree opened fire as soon as they saw the first flicker of movement from it. He had to hunker down again as bullets slammed into the ground just above it. He had no idea if the shot had come anywhere close to the men cutting down the tree. The axes continued to ring, and a few minutes later, when they stopped at last, they were replaced within moments by the sound of a long cross-cut saw. Frank bit back a curse. They had him trapped good and proper, with no way out that he could see. The tree would crush everything in its path when it fell. What Frank needed was a miracle, or some help.
Keep driving those wedges in. We don't want the tree to start binding on that saw. If it does, we'll never get it out.
Even though he'd never done anything like this before, cutting down a tree seemed like common sense to Grimshaw. You hewed and sawed through the trunk from both sides, a little lower on the side in the direction you wanted the tree to fall. It was hard, dangerous work, but not all that complicated. They had started the cuts with axes, but were now using the long two-man saws. A couple of other men worked driving wedges into the cuts on both sides with wooden mallets. Once the cuts were deeper, the saw on the cliff side would be taken out, and the wedges on that side would be removed as well. Then more wedges would be pounded into the cut on the back side to widen it and tip the tree toward the cliff. When it tipped enough, gravity would take over.
You others, keep an eye on Morgan's hidey hole. You see a whisker move, you open up on it.
Grimshaw walked around the tree, studying the cuts. They were almost deep enough, he decided. Not overlapping, but close.
You're doing fine. Another couple minutes and we'll be ready to topple that damn thing.
I'm sure as hell glad I don't do this for a living.
Yeah, no matter what a man does, there's always something worse.
Give me a gunfight any day.
Carrying his rifle, Grimshaw walked around to the back of the tree again. He stood there watching as the work continued. After a moment, he frowned a little as his nose wrinkled. A funny smell had drifted to him. It wasn't pleasant at all. Something like a cross between unwashed flesh and a rotting carcass. It was getting worse, too. Realizing suddenly what that might mean, Grimshaw stiffened. He jerked his rifle up and whirled around, and found himself face to face with a horror that had surely come crawling up out of the depths of hell. Frank heard the yelling and shooting from the trees, and he knew right away the bushwhackers weren't shooting at him. The fast, frantic sound of the gunfire told him the men were fighting for their lives.
Watch out! It's coming down!
Frank's head jerked up to look at the tree they'd been trying to fell. It was moving all right, picking up speed as it tilted forward. He had no choice. He had to get out of that Leviathan's way and hope that the ambushers had their hands too full with something else to gun him down when he came out into the open. That something else, he thought as he surged to his feet, had to be the Terror. Nothing else out here in these woods could provoke such an uproar. The tree began to topple toward the cliff. Frank ran to his right along the rim. Not only did he have to get out of the way of the massive trunk, but he had to avoid the branches too, some of which were more than big enough to break his bones and knock his brains out if they hit him. As he ran, he snapped shots toward the trees with the Winchester, but he wasn't sure anybody in there was paying attention to him. The tree came down with an impact that caused the earth to shudder. Frank's quick action had carried him well out of its way. He angled toward the trees, thinking that if he could get into that twilight world under the redwoods, he would be able to give the bushwhackers the slip. That is, if any of them survived the battle with the Terror. The noise was still going on. Frank ran into the trees. Instantly, a huge, shaggy shape darted at him. Instinct made Frank swing the Winchester toward the creature, but his finger froze on the trigger before he could pull it. He had recognized Wolf, who had obviously been waiting for him. Wolf reared up and put his front paws on Frank's shoulders. Frank winced from the pain that caused in his wounded arm, but he didn't make the big cur get down. Instead, he looped his arm around the thick, shaggy neck and gave Wolf a quick hug, glad to see that his old friend was all right.
Where are Stormy and Goldie? Take me to him, Wolf.
Wolf got down and started through the trees, glancing back to make sure that Frank was following him. A minute later, they came to a small clearing where Stormy and Goldie waited. Frank grabbed Stormy's reins and swung up into the saddle.
Let's get out of here.
But then, before they could even get started, Frank thought better of it and hauled back on the reins. He had come out here to find the Terror, he reminded himself. His close call and escaping the ambush attempt didn't really change anything. He still had to deal with the Terror, and the evidence seemed to say that the creature was close by right now. Even though Frank was wounded, it didn't make sense not to try to take advantage of that fact. He turned Stormy's head toward the sounds of the battle going on nearby. As he rode, he thumbed fresh cartridges into the rifle's loading gate. When the weapon was fully loaded, he stowed it in the saddle sheath again. If he wound up in the middle of this ruckus, it might be close work, more suited to the Colt on his hip.
It went that way!
Let it go! Find Morgan! We still got to kill him!
What about the men that thing killed?
Leave him there. We ain't got time to do anything else. Anyway, you left Nichols for the Terror, Hooley, when he was still alive. So don't go getting tender-hearted on me now.
Frank's lips drew back from his teeth in a disappointed grimace. He recognized his old friend Jack Grimshaw as the voice that gave those orders. Frank knew what he was facing now. And he knew as well that no matter how much damage the Terror might have done to Bosworth's hired killers, they still probably outnumbered him by quite a bit, and he was in no shape to face them right now. His wounded left arm throbbed, and he could barely use it. His ribs ached. His clothes were soaked, and that had started a chill in his bones. Or maybe the wound in his arm had started a fever brewing inside him. That would account for the chill, too. Regardless of the cause, he realized that he needed some rest, maybe a fire so that he could dry out, and something to eat to keep his strength up. He couldn't risk a shootout with a gang of professional killers right now. So he turned Stormy and motioned for Wolf and Goldie to follow him. He had to find a place where he could hole up for the night, a place where Grimshaw and the others wouldn't find him. Then, maybe in the morning, he could resume his search for the Terror. Moving quietly, Frank rode deeper into the woods. Damn shame about Grimshaw, Frank mused. Jack had always been one to follow the lure of so-called easy money, though. More than likely, before this was over, he was going to have to kill Jack Grimshaw. No matter how long he lived, he would never forget the sight that had met his eyes a short term earlier, Grimshaw thought. The image was seared into his brain just as surely as a brand was burned into a cow's hide. The damn thing had been huge, towering over him, and Grimshaw wasn't a small man. At first glance, it appeared that the creature had some sort of patchwork pelt of different colors and textures. Logic told Grimshaw that it was really a coat or a robe of some sort, stitched together from the hides of several different kinds of animals. The garment was so shaggy, the creature's hair and beard so long, that it was difficult to tell where one ended and the other began. But in the midst of all that hair were two burning eyes, filled with such hatred that it seemed to blast a path straight through Grimshaw to his soul, which withered for a second under the heat of that baleful gaze. He saw patches of pink scar tissue inside the beard too, and then a mouth that opened to emit a growl and a wave of fouler odors as the thing lunged at him. Grimshaw had never moved faster in his life. He ducked away from the rush, stumbled, fell, rolled, came up with his Colt in his hand, spitting fire and lead. Involuntary shouts tore loose from his throat. The rest of the men had abandoned the tree cutting and swiftly joined the battle, opening fire on the Terror in their midst. Problem was, the damn thing was so fast, it seemed to dodge the bullets as it rampaged among them, slashing right and left with hands that dealt out as much damage as talons, effortlessly killing three of the men. Grimshaw's hard cases had been in plenty of fights before, though, even if none of them had ever been like this one. They kept firing, even as the tree toppled on its own, and suddenly the Terror was gone, vanished into the shadows under the redwoods as if it had never been there. The pursuit was delayed even more because some of the horses, badly spooked by the Terror's scent, had broken free and run off. The men whose mounts were still where they had been left had to round up those other horses. By the time they started searching along the cliff, Grimshaw was certain that Frank was long gone. That was the way it turned out. One of the men thought he had caught a glimpse of Morgan running south along the cliff during the battle with the Terror, but they couldn't be sure about that. And it was next to impossible to follow tracks in the trees. All they could do was spread out and comb through the forest as best they could.
All right. Okay. You men spread out a couple hundred yards apart and keep your eyes open.
I don't like it. What if we run into that monster again? One man alone wouldn't stand a chance against that shaggy bastard.
Yeah, well, this way he can only kill one of us at a time, instead of wiping out the whole bunch.
The searchers started through the woods, heading south along the coast, since that was the only lead they had, and any lead was better than none. As soon as Grimshaw was out of sight of the others, the wet afternoon seemed lonelier than ever. With the trees closing in all around him, he might as well have been the only human being in some strange primeval world.
Damn you, Frank. Why couldn't you have just kept riding? Why'd you have to get mixed up in all this?
Frank continued working his way inland. He knew there were some hills in that direction that might offer him shelter. His stomach growled, prompting him to dig a strip of jerky out of his saddlebags and gnaw on it as he rode. He was still feverish, and his left arm now hurt from wrist to shoulder. He shivered in the saddle as chills ran through him again. Gradually, he became aware that the terrain wasn't flat anymore. It had a slope to it. Stormy climbed steadily, still weaving around the massive tree trunks. Wolf padded out ahead, while Goldie followed along behind. Because of the late hour and the overcast that was lowering even more, the shadows under the trees were thick enough so that Frank couldn't see more than a few yards in any direction. Tendrils of fog floated among the trees, also cutting down on Frank's vision. Suddenly, something huge and black loomed up right in front of them. This wasn't the Terror, Frank sensed immediately. It was too big even for that. After a moment, he realized that it was a low bluff, about 30 feet tall. And set in it, unless he was mistaken, was the round black mouth of a cave. Fate had been kind to him and led him to exactly what he needed, a place to get out of the rain, rest, and spend the night. He urged Stormy forward. The opening in the bluff was about 10 feet tall. Judging by that, the cave might be big enough not only for Frank and Wolf, but for Stormy and Goldie as well. Frank hoped that he could find some wood that wasn't too wet to burn. He really wanted to build a fire and dry out. They were approaching the cave mouth when Wolf suddenly planted his feet and his fur grew in hackles. The two horses stopped short as well and tossed their heads as if reluctant to go any closer.
Come on.
Stormy wouldn't budge, so Frank dismounted. He took hold of the reins and tried to lead the rangy gray stallion into the cave. Stormy's hooves were planted firmly on the ground, though. He wasn't budging. Neither was Wolf or Goldie.
All right. Stay out here and get wet, then.
Instantly, he felt bad for saying such a thing. He had never had a better friend than Wolf, and Stormy and Goldie were almost at the same level as the big cur. Maybe once they saw him go into the cave, they would follow. He trudged toward the opening. The smell that came from it made him wrinkle his nose. Something had crawled up in there and died. Maybe more than one something. But he wasn't going to let a little stink keep him from getting out of the rain. He stepped up into the cave mouth, something nagging at the back of his brain as he did so, and reached into his pocket to fish around for the little waterproof container in which he always kept several matches. He found it as he moved a couple of steps into the cave. The drizzle wasn't hitting him now. His fingers fumbled to open the container and shake out a match. When he had one, he snapped it to life with his thumbnail. The match flared up and cast a yellow glow over the interior of the cave. It was rounded, 10 or 12 feet high at its tallest, maybe 15 across, and an equal distance deep. Plenty of room for him, Wolf, and the two horses, Frank thought. He turned slowly, holding the match higher in his left hand so that the light from it spread all the way to the back of the cave. That was where he saw what he took at first for a sleeping bear. He stepped back sharply and dropped his right hand to the butt of his gun before he realized what he saw wasn't a bear, wasn't even alive. It was just a pile of animal pelts, dozens of them from the looks of it. They looked like they had been arranged against the wall to form a bed of sorts. He saw a lot of little bones, too, tossed here and there. Reason finally penetrated Frank's feverish brain, and he dropped the match and turned.
Oh, hell.
Standing there, in the cave entrance, silhouetted against the last of the fading gray light outside, was a huge, shaggy shape. A stench emanated from it, filling the cave and making it hard for Frank to breathe without gagging. It stood there, motionless, as if puzzled to find that it had a visitor in its home. Because that's what this cave was, Frank realized now. He had found the lair of the terror. Before Frank could do anything, Wolf attacked the terror from behind, leaping high on the creature's back and hitting it with such force that even the terror's massive bulk was jolted forward a step. Wolf's fangs flashed as he tore at his enemy. Wolf was no match for the terror. The thing reached back, dug claw-like fingers into Wolf's pelt, and plucked the big cur off him like a bug. He flung Wolf away like a bug, too, sending him crashing into the wall of the cave. By this time, Frank's Colt was in his hand. But he had given his word to Nancy Chamberlain, for one thing. And for another, he wasn't sure bullets would stop the terror, or even slow it down.
Man! Man Chamberlain!
The terror was in the middle of taking a shuffling step toward him when Frank called out. For some reason, the creature wasn't moving with the blinding speed that he had demonstrated earlier. He stopped short, and massive arms like the trunks of small trees lifted and shook. But the terror had reacted to Ben Chamberlain's name. Frank was sure of it. That wasn't proof that the creature actually was Ben, but it increased the likelihood. Frank raised his left hand, extended it toward the terror.
Listen to me. I'm not going to hurt you. I'm a friend. If you really are Ben Chamberlain, your father sent me.
Frank realized instantly that he'd made a mistake by mentioning Rutherford Chamberlain. The terror lurched toward him, swinging those massive arms. Frank ducked under the grab and whirled away from the terror. He lunged toward the cave mouth in an effort to get past the creature. But one of the terror's hands snagged his shirt and jerked him back. Frank flew across the cave and smashed into the wall. Pain exploded through his body. He bounced off and fell to the hard-packed dirt floor. The terror loomed over him, blotting out most of the fading light, and swung clubbed fists at Frank's face. Frank rolled aside just in time. The terror was definitely slower now than it had been earlier. Frank came to a stop against the wall and pushed himself to his feet, ignoring the throbbing ache that filled his body.
Ben! Ben, I know it's you! Nancy sent me. Your sister Nancy, remember her?
The terror hesitated. Frank was getting through to him. He was convinced of it. And now he thought of something else. His hand went into his pocket, found the necklace and locket he had carried there since his meeting with Nancy Chamberlain the day before. He fumbled with the locket, searching for the catch. A second later, his fingers found it, but it didn't want to open at first. Finally, as the terror came slowly toward him, Frank succeeded in opening the locket. He thrust his left hand forward, the necklace and locket dangling from his fingers.
Look at it, Ben. It's Nancy's. It belonged to your sister. And that's a picture of you in it, Ben. You!
Take it and look at it, Ben. It won't hurt you.
Slowly, the terror raised a hand and reached for the necklace. The powerful fingers ended in long, razor-sharp, claw-like nails. The creature took the necklace from him and brought it close to its face. Frank knew the terror was studying the tiny photographs inside the locket. On one side was a picture of Nancy. On the other, a pale, intense-looking young man with bushy side whiskers peered out from the sepia-toned photograph.
That's you, Ben. Remember? Remember what you used to look like? Remember Nancy?
Nancy. Nancy and Ben.
That's right. That's right.
The terror fell to its knees. Then it pitched forward on its face, either dead or out cold, and didn't move again. For a second, Frank stared at the huge, motionless body on the cave floor, and then he felt his eyes rolling up in their sockets. He had reached the end of his rope. Even though the last thing he wanted to do was pass out right here beside this huge, shaggy, murderous creature, there was nothing he could do about it. Frank lost consciousness as he was falling, and never felt himself strike the hard-packed dirt.